ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Welcome to Arts in 30, your weekly wrap of global news in arts and culture. Daniel Browning here with you. The report of a parliamentary inquiry into the live music industry has been handed down with a range of recommendations. But at the same time, yet another music festival has been cancelled. Esoteric is the latest to join the ranks, only one day before it was due to begin. What's going on with live music in Australia, and what will it mean for fans? That story coming up. But first, the headlines with Skye Kirkham. Skye, now authors have raised concerns over a recent decision by Black Ink Books.
Hi, Daniel. Yeah, Black Ink, which is one of the largest independent presses in Australia, has offered an opt-in contract to its authors that will allow the publisher to negotiate with AI companies. Now, the documents sent to the writers have suggested that it will provide new revenue streams and that their work will receive increased visibility and credibility. But the contract amendments came with short deadlines and an offer to split the proceeds 50-50. Both are issues that have raised concerns with authors and with the Australian Society of Authors, even setting aside whatever concerns might exist around copyright. The ASA told The Guardian that asking for blanket permission for all future licensing, particularly under time pressure, is unnecessary and unfair, and that they support a split of 75% to the author in circumstances where the author agrees to the proposal in the first place. This kind of marks another worrying sign for the Australian publishing industry, though, after the recent sale of companies like Text and Affirm, because many of the authors at Black Ink are not thrilled with this offer.
And the fallout from US President Donald Trump's decisions around the arts continue to be felt in the United States.
The final replacements to the Kennedy Center board in Washington, D.C. have been announced, and it has done very little to soothe the concerns of the art sector there. Hamilton has become the latest cancellation for the center. The show was due to be part of the 250th anniversary celebrations, but Lin-Manuel Miranda has told the New York Times that, quote, "The Kennedy Center was not created in this spirit, and we're not going to be part of it while it is the Trump Kennedy Center." And lead producer Jeffrey Seller commented, "It became untenable for us to participate in an organisation that had become so deeply politicised."
Now, what are some quick hits?
Well, the Stella Longlist was announced at the Adelaide Festival. The yearly prize, which has become one of Australia's most prestigious, is unusual in that it encompasses fiction, non-fiction, short stories and essays. The only requirement is that the author be a woman or non-binary. And as always, there's a remarkable collection of talent on the list, from big names like Michelle de Kretzer to debut writers like Cher Tan. The Book Show and Bookshelf have interviewed many of the authors and reviewed their books over the last year for Radio National, and you can find all of those conversations on the ABC Listen app.
Fun fact, I actually judged the Stella one year with Michelle de Kretzer.
Oh, amazing.
As you were.
Over in Paris, the Pompidou Museum has begun removing its permanent collection ahead of major renovations. Some 2,000 items will be moved, with temporary exhibitions running until September. But at that point, the museum is shutting its doors for 5 years, with a rebuild that's expected to cost 262 million euro. I'm sure there's a few galleries in Australia that would be happy to put those collections on display in the meantime.
For it to close down for 5 years is... it's quite extraordinary, but they take art very seriously in France, as they should.
As they should. In lighter news, the collectibles market has marked a strange new record with the most expensive Cheeto Puff ever sold at auction. The snack food, which resembles a Pokemon called Charizard, a dragon of sorts, began with bids of $250 US, but ended up costing more than $87,000. A spokesman for Golden told Hyperallergic, "Part of what makes this item so fun and unique is that it bridges two fandoms, Pokemon and Cheetos," which is not a sentence I ever thought I'd read. And valet to the American funk and soul composer Roy Ayers, who has died at the age of 84. Perhaps the best-known vibraphone player in the music business, his songs were hugely influential. And as a collaborator, he worked with everyone from Whitney Houston to Tyler, the Creator. Here he is speaking with the ABC's Richard Kingsmill back in 2003 about the instrument he called his own.
It's a fascinating instrument. It's very mesmerizing because of the the sound of the notes and the bar, the metal keys. I don't play the metal vibes now. I have a MIDI vibraphone, which is very easy to carry and not too much weight for the airlines because it costs a lot of money to carry that thing around. So I have a MIDI vibe. But the instrument is very soothing. It's very mesmerizing. It has an effect of, it keeps you in a state of fantasy or something like that.
My life in the sunshine. Everybody loves the sunshine. Sunshine. Everybody loves the sunshine.
Everybody loves the sunshine there by Roy Ayres. This is Arts in 30. You're with me, Daniel Browning, on ABC Radio National. Esoteric, billed as a 5-day psychedelic circus music festival, has become the latest to end up being cancelled in Australia this year. It joins a long list, including Sold Out, Splendour in the Grass, and Groove in the Moo, that have cancelled or paused their events in 2025. And last week, the Parliamentary Inquiry into Live Music handed down its recommendations, headlined by the vague outline of tax credits, restrictions to dynamic pricing, and a small levy on large music events, with funds directed to small venues and grassroots organisations. But what's actually causing these problems, and what will it mean for musicians and fans if the major festivals become a thing of the past? Well, Dr. Ben Green is lecturer in popular culture and music industry at RMIT. So Ben, what's going on with the big festivals? Is this just a cycle of renewal that happens every so often, or is this a sign of something much bigger?
Well, there is a bit of a perfect storm of challenges going on for the live music sector generally. And music festivals are really where the live music industry is focused in one time and place. So you can really see all of those issues manifest. The Australian government put out a report on Friday from its parliamentary inquiry into the Australian live music industry. Having heard submissions from around the country over the past year, and full disclosure, I made submissions and appeared before that hearing, and they report on this number of issues. So festivals are very popular in Australia. They're one of the main ways, most popular ways for Australians to engage with the arts. And there's more than 500 festivals of all different shapes and sizes around the country. What was found is that about half of those made money in the last year. Some just broke even. A third of them lost money. And that's something that a number of these festivals are able or willing to do maybe once or twice. But once that's happening for a few years in a row, they really need to reassess things. And that's what we've been seeing, a number of these festivals pulling up stumps or taking a pause or just bowing out.
Now, we'll pick that up in a moment, but I wanted to ask you about, are there a range of issues impacting festivals at the moment? Ironically, Sold Out was cancelled due to poor ticket sales. Esoteric, meanwhile, was cancelled after the local council's building surveyor denied their place of public entertainment permit the day before it was due to start. Are these all part of the same problem or very different concerns?
Well, they all lead to the same end, which is the issue of uncertainty. So there's always some uncertainty in staging an event and knowing whether people will come, but we need some base level of reliability to know that a music festival requires a lot of upfront investment, and what everything relies on is that things will actually happen in the way that they're planned, and there'll be a success and there'll be a payoff. And that's where, as well as the investment recouping, there's all of these wider benefits that music has for the community. And at the moment, what we have is that the cost of staging a festival has gone up for a number of reasons. The cost of getting artists, especially overseas artists. There's a skill shortages behind the scenes, which is something that really happened during COVID, mass departures from crew and production. Insurance costs are one of these things that have gone up hundreds of percent. And the threat of extreme weather, which we've seen play out. You know, sadly, there were festivals planned over the last week in Queensland that had to be called off, obviously. And these are things where there was a lot of investment over a long period and it just has to be called off. So all of these factors are contributing to this new level of uncertainty, which is really something that may be unsustainable. And so that's why there's a number of things feeding into it. And there's a number of levers that the government's now identified that can and should be pulled for this.
I was going to ask, are festivals as highly subscribed as they were, say, you know, 10, 15, 20 years ago? Or are there just too many festivals and perhaps the market's oversaturated and audiences are spoiled for choice?
Well, we've seen bubbles before. Around about 10 to 15 years ago, there was a bit of a slump in the festival sector, and that was partly seen as a, you know, a logical contraction after a massive expansion. But things have continued to expand, and one thing we know is that at live music generally and at festivals, attendance and revenue has more than doubled over the last decade. We've more than recovered from COVID now in the overall numbers. But within that mix, there are some, you know, more nuanced stories to tell. But we do know there's demand there. And we do know that all things being equal, for example, when local governments say stage a free festival, people turn out in droves. But there are issues of the cost of living. And one of the interesting things we've seen is that the youngest group, 18 to 24 or below, are no longer the highest group attending festivals. They were traditionally, and in the last few years, they've been overtaken by people in their later 20s. And there's a couple of ways we can look at this, and one is some cultural change, but another one is purely the material facts of the cost of living and being able to afford to attend things.
This kind of decline, how much is it about the music or the festivals themselves, the choice of bands, for instance, or ticket prices, or, you know, exorbitant ticket prices? You mentioned insurance costs. I mean, they're obviously a feature of why people pay so much for tickets.
That is part of it. But you're right that the music and the artists involved is part of the equation, especially where there is competition between festivals, and especially the big festivals that are trying to appeal to a broad audience. Think of, you know, classically a Big Day Out or a Splendour in the Grass or a Falls Festival. They try to have something for everyone. And that's a, you know, that's a classic format of festival that has its real benefits in having something for everyone. They have been struggling in some ways because it's become very expensive and uncertain to book the big headline acts from around the world, the overseas artists. There's an element of a bidding war, and there's an element of just you know, economic factors that make it more expensive to secure those artists. That goes hand in hand with an issue that's been observed, which is we don't have as many big-name Australian artists coming through the ranks now. We don't have as many Australian artists in our charts, and that's an issue, and that's put down, you know, to changes in the way people find and listen to music, especially in the age of streaming, and issues with being able to promote local content. So those things kind of go hand in hand. Perhaps if there were more Australian artists being built up and building those big audiences, they would, you know, there would be a bigger range of artists for festivals to choose from. But we do know that there are also niche festivals that will cater to particular tastes, or festivals that will have a number of local artists. And these do well. We've had festivals just over the weekend that have done quite well, like Golden Plains in Victoria or the Pitch Festival, which is a dance music festival. These were great successes. So it's really those big tent, big name festivals are the ones that are struggling right now.
Now, you mentioned the parliamentary inquiry, which has handed its findings back last week. They suggested looking at into tax credits. Would that make it much of a difference, do you think, to just tax credits, looking at tax credits?
Well, one of the issues at the moment is getting through this economic period where costs are up and returns are down. And so one of the things the government's looked at is tax offsets for live music, which recognises the public benefit that we get from live music and from the arts generally. It's just part of the usual justification for funding the arts. And when we speak of the arts, this is one of the most popular ways that Australians engage with the arts is festivals. There's a number of other things too, though. So the government has recommended that, the inquiry committee has recommended that the government work with the industry and with insurers to create a fit-for-purpose live music insurance, because currently there isn't one, and that creates a number of issues. Another thing is to provide credits in some way for young people to attend festivals, to get through that issue of younger audiences not coming through. And so one way to do that is to subsidise the festivals and in return for them offering cheap youth tickets, for example. Another way is to literally give credits like vouchers to young people. So these are some of the creative ways that these issues can be addressed.
You mentioned extreme weather events. I've just survived Cyclone Alfred here at Byron Bay, which is the home of Splendor and Blues Fest. I mean, how do you kind of insure against extreme weather events and I guess climate change when you're planning these events?
I'm glad to hear that you came through okay. It is a big issue, and it's something that it's hard because in the festival sector and the live music sector, they're dealing with the challenges that are right in front of them, which are these real, you know, cost issues, supply and demand issues, insurance, for example. And so it's hard to think about as in all parts of our lives, it's hard to think about this longer term but very great challenge of climate change, the increasing frequency and severity of extreme weather events, be it storms or rainfall or extreme heat. But over recent years, there's been a real increase in the number of festivals that have been postponed or cancelled or in some cases evacuated on the spot because of extreme weather events. And so there is this need to grapple with this issue. And again, part of the issue is insurance. What we'll see is that a festival will see that there is extreme heat predicted on a certain day or extreme storms, but if they cancel, the insurer will, and has in many cases, say, no, we won't cover you because you could have gone ahead. It was legal for you to go ahead. And the insurers will often say, we will only pay out if the government tells you not to go ahead. And the governments are reticent to do that. The government doesn't want to tell people not to do things unless they really have to. And so there's this real impasse. And again, to me, this seems like a case of we need to get each of these parties, each of these stakeholders around the table, and they need to come to some agreement on what is going to be our agreed practice in these circumstances, because we need to have some level of confidence and certainty going forward. We can't have events cancelling on the day of, because that's also not good for people's safety.
Lecturer in popular culture and music industry at RMIT, Dr. Ben Green. And the full recommendations from the parliamentary inquiry are linked from our show page on the website. You're listening to Arts in 30 on Radio National. I'm Daniel Browning. Of course, we're just one of a suite of specialist arts programs on RN and indeed the ABC, and every so often I want to bring you a particular highlight from my colleagues, something you really don't want to miss. This week, it's The Book Show, who've put together a wonderful series called My Biggest Book. They've spoken with six authors about the book that's defined their career, whether that's Emma Donoghue's Room or Marcus Zusak's The Book Thief. Claire Nichols is the host of The Book Show. Hi, Claire.
Hi, Daniel.
Now, the conversation's obviously changed when you went back to something a little bit older, when you got these authors away from the publicity circuit. So what kind of things came out? Give us a sense of what that was.
Well, it's so interesting because it's all so different. So, you know, Audrey Niffenegger, who wrote The Time Traveller's Wife, one of the best-selling books of the last 25 years, she has never seen the film adaptation of The Time Traveller's Wife, which had Eric Banner in it, this really kind of schmaltzy film version. She read the script and she went, nah, I'm walking away. The TV version she liked better, but we actually kind of tore that apart as well in the chat. She said, you know, whenever an author says, I shouldn't be saying this, but you know you've done well, trying to get Marcus Zusak to identify what he'd rewrite about The Book Thief was probably quite a cruel question from me, because Marcus is one of those authors that will always, always think, I could have done it better, I could have done it better, I could have done it better. One of the most surprising things, though, was the author Emma Donoghue. Her book Room is about this family trapped in an underground bunker, and they plan this escape, and there's this plan for the son, he's 5 years old, to play dead and get wrapped up in a rug and taken out. And I learned that Emma Donoghue used her own 5-year-old son to actually do this. She actually said, get on the floor. I'm going to wrap you up in a rug and you need to break free. It was quite traumatic from all I've heard. But yeah, there's so many different reactions. So many people are proud of their works. Then you'll have an author like Nikki Gemmell, who wrote The Bride Stripped Bare, who was really traumatised by her success. So success means different things to different writers, and that's been fascinating.
Old colleague of mine, actually, from Triple J days, Nikki Gemmell.
Yeah, yeah.
What was it like revisiting these works yourself? Because, I mean, you know, you have to go back and kind of go back over what you remember. Had your reaction to them changed compared to the first time you read them, say?
I think one of the great gifts about rereading, and I'm a big rereader, is that books change as your life goes on, right? So take, for example, The Time Traveller's Wife. That came out 23 years ago, I believe. I bought it 23 years ago. I still have the same very yellowed copy of that book. And when I was in my 20s, that book for me was about a love affair. That book was about the romance of it all. Reading that book now, I read that as a book about motherhood, and it's totally changed for me. Yet there's still so much to discover. Same for a book like The Bride Stripped Bare. You know, that was a really sexy, shocking novel when it came out in 2003. Now, reading it now as a married person, as a mother, again, it's different. And I think that's what's so good about great fiction. You can come back to it and it's changed as you have changed, but it's still so rewarding.
Perhaps one of my favourite of these chats that you've had for my biggest book, it was Hanif Qureshi talking about the Buddha of Suburbia and life after an accident that left him a tetraplegic. You brought in a short taste from that interview for us. What do we need to know before we hear this little grab?
Well, Hanif Qureshi, a hugely important British author, famous for, as you say, the Buddha of Suburbia, also the film My Beautiful Laundrette. The thing about this series is I'm asking authors to look back, but for Hanif, I think this is all the more poignant because 2 years ago on Boxing Day, he had this terrible accident where he fell and broke his neck. And Hanif Qureshi is now a tetraplegic. He is unable to walk. He is unable to use his hands. But his appetite for writing has not vanished. The minute he woke up in hospital, he started dictating blog posts to his partner. He's just published a new memoir detailing what happened in his accident. And it's this incredible thing to talk to this writer whose passion for writing has only increased despite this absolutely terrible change in life circumstances. And here is Hanif talking about that.
If you have an injury like mine and you're a tennis coach, or you're a bus driver or whatever you are, you can't go back to work. You just lie at home and you watch TV, I guess. Luckily, despite the fact that I am injured, I can still write. I can do my job. And in fact, I'm probably doing it better now than I have done for a long time. So it's a terrible irony that this injury has brought out the best in me.
Hanif Qureshi speaking with Claire Nichols on The Book Show on Radio National. And you can find the full series of My Biggest Book featuring everyone from Audrey Niffenegger to Marcus Zusak on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts. Every week here on Arts in 30, I'm joined by an expert from across the ABC's music networks to bring you the one track you should be listening to. And this week, Taj Aldeeb from ABC Classic joins me. Taj, welcome. What's our track of the week?
Get ready to put some red rose between your teeth first, because you're about to listen to the Tango Fusion by Albert Lawrence Di Miola playing Oblivion, which is originally by Astor Piazzolla. He's one of the greatest guitarists that we've got at the moment. I think he's 70 this year. He's an American guitarist, and he's so known for his work in jazz fusion and world music in general. He got really popular when he joined Chick Corea in 1974, I believe. He worked or studied in Berklee music. He is a Grammy winner. He's all the above. But this track is absolutely one of my absolute favorite because I love Astor Piazzolla as well. He brought in the tango to the concert kind of world. He brought it from the streets into the kind of auditoriums of the world.
So Al's a great guitarist, not a name I'm immediately familiar with.
Yes.
But why is this the track that you're obsessed with at the moment?
I mean, I personally probably have heard of every single version of Oblivion by Piazzolla that existed in the world. And I've been really listening to lots of guitars in the past month, so I thought we might as well bring them all together. I love the fusions that it's brought up. And it's so melancholic, so nostalgic, and I'm a sucker for these.
What does Al do with a tango that other people don't, perhaps?
There's a lot of guitarists that no matter what they do, like when you hear them talk, they'll be a different person from then holding the guitar. There's such a great feeling when you look at him just holding the guitar and then he goes into a completely different world. Tango is usually a lot of push and pull, while this kind of takes you a little bit more of a on a journey with the guitar instead of that push and pull that you usually hear with a tango. So it's quite easy to listen to. You can dance to it. You can, I don't know, move your eyebrows if you can't move physically. Do whatever you want, but definitely have a red rose between your teeth.
Dancing hands, dancing hands. Hey, do you want to throw to the song, just play us out?
Let's do it. This is Oblivion, originally by Piazzolla, but you're hearing it now by Albert Lawrence Di Meola.
Thank you.
That was Oblivion by Al Di Meola, our track of the week, chosen by our music correspondent, Taj Aldeeb. And that's all we have time for today, but remember you can listen back whenever you want on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts. If you're enjoying the show, tell a friend. Arts in 30 is produced by Sky Kirkham. C. Benedict is our executive producer. Elise Simons, our sound engineer. I'm Daniel Browning. I'll catch you next time for more Arts in 30.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.